Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the April 16th, 2026 Behind Our Eyes book launch. Thank you for coming tonight. We're going to be talking about a romance adventure fantasy novel co-authored by Juliana Kotis and Anthony Candela. And it's been independently published with assistance by DLD Books. We all know DLD Books. So about the authors, am I saying Juliana's name correctly? It's
Yes.
Kotis or Kotis?
CODIS.
Kotis. Okay. Juliana M. Kotis. Prior to her career as a poetry, short story, and novella writer, Juliana worked as a professional dancer, model, and veterinary technician. She's in the process of publishing her first set of works, including a short story and a romance adventure novel. Anthony Candela has worked as a rehabilitation professional in the field of blindness and visual impairments for more than 45 years. His work has included promoting technology awareness and employment, and he has a special interest in enhancing the development of blindness professionals. He's a retired athlete, loves movies and sports, reading, writing, and Tony, I know you have quite a few publications out, so at some point, I would love to hear you talk about each one of your publications. I don't know if you want to do it now or you want to do it at the end. And if Juliana has any that you want to mention as well, we would really love to hear that too. Okay? So I don't know
Okay.
where you want to put that, but somewhere we'll get it in. So it'll be in the recording.
Okay.
I'm going to go on and talk and give a little blurb about the book, and then we'll get started. Around 14,000 years ago, a wet period that lasted for nearly 8 millennia transformed the dry Sahara into a second Garden of Eden. Various factions feared that scientists would unearth information about the ancient inhabitants that would upset the status quo of the region. Still, Desiree would go there, risking her life to shed light on the civilization that lived in the Green Sahara and uncover secrets about the origins of the human race. In the midst of the fire of the desert sands, she will find love and, more important, herself. All right. So thank you. Welcome, Juliana, and welcome, Tony. I have some questions for you, and we'll just get right into them. So I want to know, and like I listened to your interview with Peter on In Perspective, and I loved the things you were talking about in especially the fact that this book might lead into another book. But what I really want to know is like how you found one another through the writing of this book, because that was probably one of the most intriguing things that I found about listening to the interview on in perspective. So are you okay with talking about that first?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, okay.
I'm okay with talking about anything as you want. But and it's not often that we writers get to listen to other writers who have co-authored together. So, we're kind of happy to talk about it a little bit. And it's a different experience because you have to be constantly in communications with your co-author. And you have to be able to, I would not say compromise. What you have to do is you have to be able to come to agreement on how something will be written or depicted. The reason I say not necessarily compromise is compromise tends to just water everything down. So I think it's better just to go with a way that you're going to go with something. How are you going to say those words? How are you going to depict that scene or that character? Let your beta readers start to give you some critique on that. And ultimately, the reading public will tell you. So we had to basically agree that we were going to work on this together. It started out that I was helping her anyways, because she began the book as a short story assignment in a writing class, Juliana did. And I came along about a third of the way into this, and I was helping her tweak her language and fix things a little bit. And next thing you know, I got so excited about it that I wanted to write as well. So she had outlined it all already pretty much and had conceptualized it. It's her creative genius, this book.
Okay.
And so we had that to start with. It was her creative genius. My job and her job was to not let me ruin it. And I guess we came through that okay.
So did you meet in the writing class? Did you know each other prior to that?
Well, we knew each other because she needed like somebody to help her to tweak her writing for various college classes she was taking. And so a friend of a friend connected us together. And so I
Wow.
started out kind of more like her editor than anything else. And then we did two things. I became her co-author, and then we became boyfriend and girlfriend. So we really complicated things.
Oh,
So,
you got all the levels covered.
yeah. Well, and I would say it's a little bit high risk to do it. But you spend enough time together solving various problems and learning how to deal with disagreements when they come up in general. So what's another disagreement? How we're going to write the scene in this book? It's just another thing to work through. So it just molded all together into one thing. So then we wrote and we kept writing, and the book kept getting bigger and bigger, and that was good. It's not a very big book, but it's a nice sized novel, and I think about 85,000 words, something like that. Not a large novel, but a proper novel. And so we did all that, and until even while it was going through the editing process that the DLD Publications helped us with, because they helped us to self-publish it. That's Leonore and David Dvorkin. They were making suggestions to us, and Juliana and I had to go back and forth together on that. My tendency, by the way, when an editor suggests something, is to take their suggestion, unless it's like really confused or injurious. I tend to take their suggestion, but I've got a lot of practice. So those books that I have written before have given me that practice. For Juliana, this is like her first publication, and so she's going through shock every time something happens. And I'm going to no, it's okay, it's
No.
okay.
This is
We can,
okay. This is the way it's supposed to work,
yeah.
right?
Or here's how we will finesse it. You get really good at finessing it, so that here I can write something that I think Leonore would like. But that will keep us happy at the same time. And I got really good at that, within like 10, 15 minutes of being confronted with whatever the issue was, we were solving the problem.
So
You
the
have to get that
yeah
fast.
you do yeah there's a level of getting to know and how to communicate with editors because editors are as different as bread and butter or as similar depending on I guess depending on a lot of things and some editors are very aloof and they only want to talk about what's essential to the story and everything else is just that's it. And then there are editors that are more interactive and Leonore and David are like that. And but when I did my first book with them, I had no idea what to expect. So it is kind of shocking because all of a sudden someone's picking your words apart and saying, let's do this and let's do that. And it's something to get used to.
Sure.
Yeah.
You get a perspective when anybody other than yourselves reads what you just wrote. You get a perspective on, does it even make any sense what you wrote? I mean, you're so into it that you have lost
Yes.
the forest before the tree. So thank goodness for these outside perspectives.
Yes, I agree. Totally. You can't write in a bubble. I mean, you can write in a bubble, but I don't think you can expect to write what you want other people to read, the public. You need the public to you need people to like you said, broaden the perspective, because sometimes we're right in the head of the needle. Let me ask you, the cover of the book, did DLD do the cover as well? Or was that
Actually,
something?
Juliana and I designed that cover. We knew what we wanted.
Right.
So it was actually, now that I'm thinking, it was a team effort. So David and Leonor put us in touch with a cover designer that lives out in the Denver area where they live. And what we did was we worked out between the two of us what we would like the cover to have in it. And Juliana did most of the work there.
Wonderful,
So
yeah.
we wanted the girl, we wanted the guy, we wanted a desert in the background, we wanted some sign of greenery. Because in the present day, when the book takes place, the Sahara is a dry desert again. But we
Right.
wanted some greenery, so I think that got in there. I had to have the Jeep and the rifle that the guy uses.
Right.
I had to have that because I'm a guy. So we had that in there, and we made Desiree, just as capable looking and just as pretty and sexy as she is, the character is. And then we put that whole idea scheme down on paper, just wrote it all down. We'd like to have this here, the guy there, this here. And then the book design, I even found some links to places where they could get pictures of the weapon and pictures of a vehicle of some type, some kind of a Jeep or personnel
Like a
vehicle
safari field,
like a Jeep.
right?
Yeah. So then the book design fellow, he did the rest of it. He found it. And then we went a couple of times around, and David and Leonor weighed in a little bit on that too. And Juliana did the eyeballing of that because I don't have any eyesight, but she has eyesight. She has partial vision. And so we all chipped in, and that's how we got to the cover that we got.
Wow. Yeah, that's it's funny. Did any of your other covers of your other books get such teamwork, or was it or were they more like you one individual pretty much did everything and then you said okay.
Okay, so now I get to talk about the other books real fast.
Yes.
You
I had to
sneaky
put it in
person,
somewhere.
you. So in my memoir, Stand Up or Sit Out, Memories and Musings of a Blind Wrestler, Runner, and All-Around Regular Guy, that memoir is about life lessons learned as a blind athlete. So that's what that book was about. It was a memoir. In that one, I was using a vanity press for that one, Christian Faith Publishing. So you pay them $3,500, and then they do basically what David and Leonor does. They do all of the work, and they have
Okay.
editors, and they have book design covers, and they send it off to the printers, and then they put it out there for the resellers, the Amazon.coms, and all that stuff. So they had professional book design covers, and so I basically sat on the telephone with my agent, and we discussed ideas about the book. And she started looking through stock footage, and she said, "Okay, now I'm really understanding the book, because it's a good thing that we talk, because agents don't read the book that much, the
Right.
representative." So she sent me about a dozen possibilities. And then for the second book, my science fiction novella, Vision Dreams, a Parable, that's about blind people in a dystopian society, who take a big risk on getting artificial eyesight. And the same thing happened there. a whole bunch of possibilities got sent to me. And then I brought them to a coworker. I was working a part-time job, and she happened to be in book editing. And so I brought it to her, and she said, okay, this is perfect for your memoir, and okay, this is perfect for your science fiction novella. And so that's how I got those. And then for my third book that I've published, which is a collection of essays, What Should Not Remain Silent. It's just a co collection of essays I wrote from 2022 to 2024. That I had an idea of my own. I sent it to David Dworkin, and he found what I wanted. All I wanted was an image of those three monkeys: see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. That's all I wanted there, and maybe a little background. David found something really good. Some people have said that you could have done a little better on that one, but I got what I wanted, and David gave me what I wanted, and so that's how I got the book covers for the other books that I wrote.
I've had the same experiences. Like, a book cover is never a simple thing. And if you get it right the first time you ask, you're lucky. Because it is. It's a representation and a symbol of your story. And it's just as important. I go and I try to get my book covers done before I'm even finished writing the book. I think it focuses me when I'm writing the book. The cover is just part of that whole process. So you talked about the criticism of that one book cover. So what is the constructive feedback you and Juliana have received about Fire on the Desert Sands?
Everybody loves it. We have advertising cards that David helped us to
Oh,
obtain.
yay!
It's got the picture of the cover on the card. We bring them to bookstores and to libraries and places like that. We ask them, can they keep a stack of them here? And
Wonderful. Great
Juliana,
idea.
we were in Barnes and Nobles. Juliana was in Barnes and Nobles, and she was looking to see if they had the book on the shelf. And she had the card in her hand, and so she's got the card, and she's looking, and she's got the picture of the cover right in her face because she's got the card in her hand, and she's looking to see if she could spot the book on the shelf. And people all around her saw the card. They said, are you looking for that book? And we don't see it here, but let me have that card. That is one heck of a cover. This is really intriguing. I'm going to buy that book. So everybody
Excellent.
loves the cover.
That's what it's supposed to do, right? That's the eye candy that's going to get them to pick up the book and flip it to the back and read the back cover and go, I'm going to pick that up and I'm going to get it. Yeah, wonderful. That's excellent.
It's kind of a shame, I guess, that people do judge a book by its cover, but I guess that's what happens.
Wow. So you talked a little bit about the publishing process. How long did it actually take from the time you sent the manuscript in to getting that the first draft copy?
I would say. Well, Leonor jumped on it within a month or so of getting. I would say, since this one was the self-published book, I guess from beginning of sending in the manuscript, we had already gone through beta readings, about six or seven different beta readings. So when we finally sent it to Leonor, it was mostly all ready to go, and we did more tweaking. So I'd say about 9 months at the outside. She worked hard, and she worked fast at it. So it took about 9 months altogether from initial submission of manuscript to the book actually hitting the shelves.
That is definitely one of the most valuable things about independent publishing. It's faster. Definitely. Definitely faster. So did you use beta readers with your other books? And could you talk a little about the value of your beta readers?
I reached out to whoever I knew, and then I started joining groups and asking if anybody knew of anybody or does anybody who's reading this message be willing to beta read? And so I got people, friends of friends and members of groups and relatives, a cousin, an uncle, read Fire on the Desert Sands. The wife of a former co-worker, she read it. And the other books, it was kind of a similar thing, just contacts everywhere. And what beta readers do is they give you their impression, based on how much they absorbed and how much they could absorb and how much they could pay attention, and kind of how skillful a writer they are and how analytical they're being or they want to be when they're doing this for you. Most of the time, they're doing it for free. I have paid for beta reading a couple of times, not too much money, but I have. And so you're going to get what you're going to get. So what you end up having to do is you have to, it's kind of like, I think I'm not Jewish, but I think it must be like reading the Torah. So you have to kind of work your way through whatever the beta reader said to get at the deeper truths that might actually be there that they're not saying, but you probably should be paying attention to with regard to your manuscript. And you have to be courageous enough and diligent enough to really dig in, and say, okay, now what
Yes.
they're saying looks, sounds good and seems right. I'm happy about that. I'll go with that. But I also need to know what might seem wrong. And so you end up getting from your beta readers whatever they're going to give you, whatever they can give you, and then whatever you can pull out of what they have said to you.
Yes, for sure. And do you give them a set of questions or guidelines? When you give them your writing.
Just a few general ones because I don't want to scare them away. So it's a
Okay.
delicate process. But
Yeah.
I do say one thing. First of all, the standard thing whenever you send your book to an editor or to an agent, which is after you read the first chapter, do you still want to keep reading the book?
Yes, that's
Number
right.
one, and
Yep.
don't forget to answer that question. As soon as you finish that first chapter, or I might say the prologue in chapter one, if it's like
Right.
that, then write down, make a note. How do you feel? How do you feel right now? Do you want to keep going? And one of the beta readers for Fire in the Desert Sands must have said something because what I ended up doing at the end of the prologue, it was kind of a longer prologue, so it was kind of like the first chapter, is I wove around to something that was going to be there anyways, but I wove the mystery and the tension right away, right into the end of the prologue. And another beta reader came back to me and says, if it wasn't for that last paragraph, I might not have been quite as interested, but because you had that last paragraph there where you introduced all that tension and mystery and everything, that now I had to go on. So that's how you do
Yes.
it. That's the way it goes.
Yes. That is true. And so what is the turnaround you usually give beta readers? 2 months, 3 months, 4 weeks?
I wait about a month before I stop bothering them and I start checking in with them to see how they're doing. And that's about as much pressure as I put on them.
Yeah,
I guess they're doing me a favor, unless it's a paid arrangement, in which case they and I will say, okay, then how about we agree on a certain time frame?
Right.
But that I've only done that once out of all 15 beta readers I've ever used in my entire writing life. The rest of the time I kind of handle them with gentleness and kid gloves.
Yes. Now, I'm glad we're talking about this because I've been using beta readers forever, and but there is a dilemma though that I came across when I switched genres. The beta readers I had for my poetry and my nonfiction did not want to read my women's fiction books. I had to find a whole new set of
Oh,
beta readers. So
yes.
that was something I wasn't expecting at all. But That's what happens. You change genres and you might find that you don't get the same beta readers. But that was, but you know, we I overcame that, of course. So, you're diligent, like you said, and you pay attention and you stick with it, you will get things done. And listening to your beta readers, did you find that like they that more than one of them brought up a certain point in the book, and then maybe depending, like if five people are saying they didn't like this or they wanted more of that. Did you listen to that? Did you? Yeah.
With Fire in the Desert Sands, a couple of people said, they said it much less directly, but it was very understandable. A little too much science. You got to tone down the science. And
Wow.
one person who I gave the book to after it was published, and like an 80-year-old woman, because she's my next door neighbor, said, "Too much sex. You're not the right demographic. My demographic is, never mind. I don't want to insult her. So, no,
Yes, yes.
demographic is like one third of her age,
Well, that's all she had to say then. She enjoyed everything else, then hey, it's pretty good.
I mean, I was going to be naughty and tell her, read the book again, see how you feel,
Go about a second
Yeah.
down. Oh wow. All right, so let's in terms of your
Sorry.
book, that's funny. So who? So we're gonna. Who is your favorite character, and why?
Well, my favorite character is Jacob, and Juliana's favorite character is Desiree.
Of course, right? Yeah.
And she kind of models chunks of Desiree on herself. They both have a mean stepmother in their lives. They've both been interested in the origins of the human race and wanting to know
Right.
how civilization developed and evolved, from early
Right.
Homo sapiens. So all those things. And they both have red hair, which is a good thing too. So that's her. And Jacob, who is the guy who ends up having to escort Desiree across the desert to get to the digs because she missed the caravan where the science team was, and they were waiting for her, but she got there late. So she ended up needing an escort to get across the desert to the digs. So Jacob got assigned that he's like a soldier of fortune and big, strong, strapping guy, with all sorts of skills and,
Oh no, that
so strong that there's nothing that he can't do. And I might have been like that for maybe 10 years of my life when I was a high school and college wrestler. So I remember actually being able to do things with my body, but that's like a long time ago. And so
was.
he's that guy. He has nothing he couldn't do, and he was smart, and he knew how to use he knew it. He was an engineer by training. He could create things and fix things and invent things. And nothing scared him at all. And so he's my favorite. And Desiree is definitely Juliana's favorite because not only does she have all these things she's got to overcome, but in order for her to achieve her dream, she's really, really going to have to be very courageous and much stronger than she ever thought she was going to have to be. I think Juliana, I think, really resonates to that. She's gone through a lot of hardships in her own life, and I think that helps her to resonate with the character who just keeps having to meet the next difficult thing that she comes across, one after the next, after the next, after the next. And so that's what happens to Desiree in the book.
So talk about your conflict character, the main one. His name is Sean, right?
Sean, yeah. So when Jacob was it was in the he was in the Israeli Defense Force, and he was a specialist. And then after he retired, they actually hired him back on to be kind of like a private soldier of fortune. And they needed him to help with a mission to in Iran. So timely given what's going on now, but that, so way back he had to do that. And so that was going on. Meanwhile, Sean is in the United States Marines, and they're over there in the Middle East too. And where the two of them come together and they're fighting side by side is to defeat ISIS. So this is when ISIS was building up, and so the Israeli army and the American army and a few other armies were working together, and so that's how they meet, and they work on projects together, and things happen to each of them that they end up with some PTSD, each one of them. You'll see this when I read my little passage to you, how that pops up. The then what happens is they both finish their military service. Sean ends up getting connected to, I'll call them the bad guys, that faction in Eastern Libya that thinks they are the rightful owners of the land in that region, and those are the ones who don't want the scientists to find out too much, because they're afraid that whatever the scientists find out, the anthropologists and archaeologists, it might just mean that it will show that they don't really have the rights of the land. Now Jacob, so that's Sean. Now he's joined up with them. Now Jacob has joined up what I'm going to call the good guys, that tribe of people who believe they have the rights of the land, and they have fought side by side. Sean and his bad guy friends, and Jacob and his good guy friends, and they know about each other, and they know that they're basically, in the end, their ultimate enemy is each other. Jacob has to worry about what Sean is going to do, and that Sean is probably going to try to kill him, and Sean has to worry about what Jacob's going to do, and that Jacob would just as soon kill him. And so that's how we have the good guys and the bad guys. Now, turns out Desiree had met Sean years before at an internship, and they had a little sexual relationship, and then Sean cheated on her, and she hates his guts now, and she doesn't know that she's going to run into him in the desert. But there they all are, and then they end up, and then they end up in the biggest part of the adventure. The three of them end up together, just the three of them together for the biggest part of the adventure.
And let me tell you, it's exciting. Because
Oh
they get lose their tempers and things happen and you're like, "Woo, all right."
yeah.
You said you had something to read.
I
Would you like to
do.
read it?
Oh, sure.
All right. And then
Now,
after you finish reading, we'll go into questions. How's that sound? All
okay.
right.
Now I warn you, this is one of those exciting scenes. You're going to be exhausted after this, let me tell you. Okay. So what's happened is they make their way to the digs, and they get to a place where they should have started to encounter the science team, and there's nobody around. So Jacob and Desiree are looking for the science team, and they figure Sean and his men must have captured them and are holding them somewhere. So they can't find them. They try to inspect the digs. They fall into a hole. Now they're down like 30 feet under the ground. Next thing you know, Sean falls through the hole with them. He's there to, he thinks he's about to shoot them, but he falls through the hole because Jacob shoots him in the leg. And now the three of them are down there, and then they go down another long level down. So now they're really under the ground. They find an underground stream. Then that stream leads to this lake that is glowing because it's got bioluminescent plants and animals on its bottom. And that blue glow is what lights up the area down there so they could see. They go around the lake, they go into a cavern, they walk through a long, long passageway, and they get to the top of a flight of stairs. This is all necessary background information for my passage. They get to the top of this flight of stairs, they go down the steep flight of stairs, they see all sorts of cave paintings on the walls. They leave Desiree there to analyze the cave paintings. Jacob and Sean go to the bottom. There's all sorts of structures down there. Some are in rubble, and others are sort of half still together. Sean looks at these mini pyramids that he believes are burial crypts. It's kind of like pre-pyramid stage. It's like probably a couple of thousand years before the Egyptians started building their real pyramids. But there they are. And Jacob wanders and he finds the slab laying in the ground that might be covering up another hole, but there's inscriptions on the slab. So the three of them converge and they look at it and they take some pictures of it and they say, "We got to get this to a cryptographer to see if they can't. This could be a Rosetta Stone of some type." And so they go back to the steps to sit down and have some lunch. And Jacob remembers that he forgot his backpack over by the slab, and now is when the passage begins. Whoops. Oh, I'm looking at my notes here. I'm supposed to tell you about the tropes. The tropes we have, the tropes are damsel in distress trope, the knight in shining armor trope, and the damsel in distress pulling herself together and becoming the strong one trope. So that's what we have in here.
Okay.
Okay. Here we go. Escaping the cave-in. Meanwhile, Jacob slowly walked to the far side of the ruin. Then something caused him to look up. Examining the top of the cave, he noticed something quite alarming. Grabbing his pack and sprinting back to the steps, Jacob shouted, "Guys, get up! Sand is beginning to pour down from the top of the cave. We have to get up the steps before the roof gives out." Desiree and Sean looked up. Grabbing their packs, they began to run. Gasping for air as they got to the top, they turned to the passageway leading back to the lake. Sean called out, "Why do we have to rush away so quickly? I wanted to re-examine the burial crypts. Look behind you and you tell me." Just then, the top of the cave gave way, and giant rocks and sand fell onto the steps, covering the stairway and blocking the view of the ancient structures at the bottom. They imagined the worst. The stone wall with the drawings split in half and crumbling into a pile of dust, never to be seen again, and never to be real to reveal its secrets. They mourned the possibility that evidence of the deceased ancients, their structures, and perhaps their written language would forever be buried in the rubble. "Desiree," Jacob yelled, "don't stop, keep running. Give me your backpack and your hand." As she obeyed and reached out to him, Jacob could see the horror in her face. Grabbing her backpack and taking her hand, Jacob called to Sean. "Sean, can you keep up?" Sean was at Desiree's heels. "I think so," he yelled. "But are you sure we should head back? Isn't that where all this started? I don't see anywhere else to go." Reluctantly, and with as much speed as they could muster, the threesome plowed back in the direction they had come from. Thoughts of returning to a calm and beautifully glowing lake filled their minds. Frightened, Desiree also thought of the idyllic lake in which she so luxuriously, sensuously, and safely bathed in back home. She longed to be there right now. Sean began to grow tired, his injured leg catching up to him. He fell farther and farther behind, his breath growing short. Jacob and Desiree couldn't hear his increasingly feeble calls, which were masked by the sound of the falling rubble. Desiree called out, "Jacob, I can't feel Sean behind me." Jacob looked and saw Sean off in the distance. "Sean, hurry up." They watched in horror as instead of speeding up, Sean slowed to a stop, trapped in motionlessness. Before Jacob could figure out that Sean was experiencing a deadly combination of psychological and physical paralysis, the foundation of the cave began to crumble. Sean let out a hair-raising scream. Then he disappeared into a hole that had opened up along the side of the passage. Desiree screamed, "I can't see him. Jacob, we've got to go back and get Sean. We can't help him," Jacob said. "Don't stop. We need to get the hell out of here. Keep running." Jacob's yelling and pulling helped Desiree to speed up and at least temporarily put Sean's welfare out of her mind. After what seemed like an eternity, Desiree saw something. Shocked, she purposely crashed into Jacob, falling to the ground and clutching his legs. What's the matter, Desiree? It's my mother. She's smiling and beckoning us to change direction. Are you hallucinating? I don't see anything. Looking off to their left and pointing, she said, I don't know how we missed that before, but I think there might be an opening somewhere nearby. What makes you think so? Come on, Jacob. We don't have time to debate. Let's get over there. Huge chunks of rock and sand were falling all around them, damaging the passageway. They zigzagged their way toward the place Desiree hoped might be their salvation, dodging debris with every step. As they drew close, Jacob noticed light coming from above. Initially blocked by the vegetation, the glow appeared to him like an angel carrying a torch, showing them the way to heaven. Dismissing the thought that one must usually be dead in order to approach the pearly gates, Jacob grabbed Desiree and said, That must be the glow we saw earlier. We can climb to the surface using the bushes in this weird-looking tree. The entrance isn't that far up. He turned to Desiree. Her face was ashen with panic. Come on, my brave girl, he said. Don't give up. Stand on my shoulders and grab a branch of the tree, and then another branch till you reach the top. I'll be close beneath you all the way. As she managed only to sob into Jacob's shoulder, Desiree's body began to shiver. It was my mother. She was just here. She pointed the way to this place. Pushing her to arm's length, Jacob, whoops, looked at Desiree, first as if she were crazy, and then with understanding. She had proven over and over that she possessed special gifts. They could figure this out later, but now it was survival time. Delaying no longer, he ordered her to stand on his hands. I'll boost you up and you can climb. Come on, Desiree, snap out of it. Pulling herself together, Desiree hugged him and kissed his cheek. Following his instructions, she said, It's a good thing I did a lot of tree climbing in my tomboy days. With that, and without Jacob's help, she jumped up and grabbed one of the branches. She was glad that her father had taught her how to climb as a girl, much against her stepmother's objections. Jacob, there's an exit above me, and I can climb out by swinging from branch to branch and then up. Follow me. Jacob laughed. Of course, I'll follow you anywhere. Scrambling out of the hole and flinging herself face down to kiss the ground, Desiree ended up with a mouthful of sand, spitting it out as she rose. To her relief, she saw Jacob emerge behind her. They got up and ran away from the entrance, just in a nick of time. The hole and the structure beneath it caved in with the force of an avalanche. Dirt and debris shot up into the air and then fell to the ground, covering the entrance with rock, sand, and mud. Desiree saw Jacob staring at the falling debris. He didn't freak out. Thank God, she thought. Perhaps he's finally free of the 1,000-yard stare. After running several yards from the now completely covered hole, they stopped and looked around. To their amazement, the scene in which they found themselves included some trees, some grass, and a pond. It looks like we reached a mini oasis, Desiree said. Let's sit in the shade, Jacob agreed. But he couldn't help wondering what remained after the land ceiling collapsed. Had the underground stream and lake been obliterated with the cave-in? And how could they be in an oasis? The end.
Well done. Thank you, Tony. Wonderful.
I'm exhausted. I don't
Can
know about you.
you imagine those narrators that have to narrate all those novels?
Yeah.
They
You know how
have
many
to build
times I've climbed that hole like 100 times.
Oh, thank you so much for reading that. I really hope it gets some people intrigued and pick up your book and listen to it for sure. All right, so we're going to open to questions. My co-host Linda Wright is here to help me with hands. So if anybody would like to ask a question, please raise your hand. Linda will call on you.
Okay, we have Brad.
Hey there, Tony.
Hey,
Good
Brad.
presentation here. I have a question and a comment. So, I have pretty much studied the history of humans and such and so on. This business of this sort of Garden of Eden in Sahara Desert, did that really happen, or is that part of the fantasy?
That the Green Sahara really did happen. Yes. about 14,000 years ago. It has something to do with the way the Earth tilts. The tilt of the Earth's axis itself actually shifts. And it will happen again, probably, maybe, I don't know, 10 to 20,000 years in the future. It will happen again. But that really did
So
happen.
this was like post Ice Age.
Let me think about when the, yeah, probably, yeah. You know, it was like from 14,000 BCE to about, oh, I'd say about 4,000, 5,000. So there, I don't know if there was an ice age after that. It would have been in Europe. So it may have been, it was definitely post some ice age, but it might have preceded another ice age. See,
Okay,
as
cool.
yeah, you know,
And
as the Earth tilted back in the other direction, so as it tilted the way it tilted, it actually got warmer. And what that caused to happen was the Mediterranean started to evaporate and dump rain on the Sahara. Then when it tilted back in the other direction, when there could have been another ice age, it actually got cooler, and now there wasn't all that evaporation and rain being dumped on the desert, and then we ended up with a dry desert again.
a great choice for a setting. Just my comment is, you said one of your beta readers said too much science.
Yeah.
I hope if I ever get any of my sci-fi published that someone says that about it, because they said that about Andy Weir's book, The Martian, and look how well that did. So.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? I'm about to post this week a book review on the newest book, which they made a movie out of called Project Hail Mary.
Oh
And
yeah,
if.
I wrote it. I wrote you a comment. I read your. You did post it to the list, and I
Oh,
read it, and I
yeah.
wrote. So yeah, as a matter of fact, as a result of that, I reread the book. And some people might say too much science, but like, I mean, it depends, like, what your audience is, right? I mean, some people really like hard science fiction. So, what do you see as your audience for this?
It, well, since I did kind of like tone it down just enough. Young and middle-aged women. It's a romance novel first and foremost, and an adventure novel next, and a fantasy novel next. Some of Desiree's clairvoyance, like her ability to see her mother, is in the fantasy end of this whole thing. But I think the main audience is probably gonna still be the romance novel audience. And with that though, who can predict? We're just gonna try to advertise it as much as possible and put it out there, and whoever buys it, buys it.
I mean, so it almost sounds a little bit like Outlander. They couldn't really classify it. It was a romance. It had time travel. It had battles. Nobody really knows how to classify it, but a lot of people really liked it. So
Yeah,
best of
yeah.
luck with this. Thanks for
Thank
the,
you.
answering my questions.
Thanks, Brad.
All right. Any other hands, Linda?
Not at the moment.
Well, I can tell you what still has to happen in the book. I'm not gonna spoil it. Don't worry. They still have
All
to.
right.
So that now they're sort of where they can think and reconnoiter. They use some of Desiree's dream work, or she has this uncanny ability to have these dreams that, if you read them right, they actually point to tangible realities. So they have to find the missing scientists. So they use some of what she was imaging in her dreams, and they have and that's leading them toward where the scientists are being held. They have to deal with the bad guys on two levels.
Yeah,
One,
we
that
don't know what happened with Sean, right? We're assuming he's gone, but he might not be.
that's the very good, because that could be the roots of a sequel right there. And we did that on purpose. We did that on purpose. But there's the rest of the bad guys, including the bad guys, Sean's boss, a guy named Ahmed. And so they got to deal with them. And then they've got to have to deal with the aftermath of what just happened to the digs. You know, the digs really got obliterated. That it was most likely We don't know for sure, but it is most likely, like 90% certain, that the bad guys set off, explosive charges and blew up the place, and that's why all that happened. That's most likely what happened. So now they've got still, eyewitnesses of the structures that were down there. I mean, Sean and Desiree and Jacob saw
Yeah,
all this stuff, right?
they have
And
the photos and everything, right?
and the whether or not they got destroyed, obliterated completely or not, the only way you're ever going to know that is to dig them up. And we bring in some technology like ground penetrating radar and stuff like that they could use, to see what's down there and all that kind of stuff. But that has to still be all determined. And then eventually our heroes will go home. They'll go to where Desiree grew up, in the Pacific Northwest. So they don't die. They don't die. They live. Everybody's
Yeah,
good at
well, the
the
romance is that everybody they live happily ever after. They get through their co conflicts and their dangers, and then they come back together and realize they want to be together. So,
Yes. And
yeah.
if anybody cares, and it just between when they get out of that hole and the end of the book, there's at least five or six really, really juicy sex scenes, if anybody cares
Okay.
about
Okay, we have
that.
Deborah with a question. Hi, Anthony.
Hey,
I'm
Deb.
just excited to hear you read the book. It sounds very exciting. And I just want to say congratulations to you guys, and I pray that everything goes exceptionally well, but that I'm going to have to get myself a copy so that I can listen to it as well. Just wanted to find out what kind of advertising or how are you sort of pushing the book? What places are you seeking to share the book?
Probably not as well as we should. So I'll say that right up front. But we've got it on all our postings. I've got advertisements. We go around New York, Manhattan and New York City with our advertising cards, and do a little bit of posting through I think it's DL, not DLD, D2 Digital, and
Draft to digital.
Draft 2 Digital. I do speaking engagements, like
Great.
this one, and some neighborhood ones, and people's podcasts, and with the express purpose of advertising the books that way. Not nearly as strong as if I should be or we should be doing it. We're just not that good at it.
Well, that's
Well,
good though. You're getting started, and that's the main thing. Sounds like you've got a great book. I enjoyed listening.
thanks. Thank you.
You know, Tony, this is Annie. I don't think any of us are really good at marketing, unless we are a marketer, like unless we're actually doing it for a living, to and I that's like the one thing. If I could go back and change anything, it would be to be able to have a better resource for marketing for my books. Maybe we should, I don't know, maybe we can get a group discount for somebody who will take on all our books for us. I don't know.
Well, Lord knows, I get hit every day with a new and different entity out there that wants to
Oh,
help.
yeah.
And I've signed up for some of these in the past with my other books. I've spent a lot of money on different things, social media campaigns, and to the international book fairs. I've had my book shown at international book fairs, and I spent thousands and thousands of dollars altogether on these things. And oh, done a TV interview, a couple of radio interviews in the past, and to this very day, luckily, thankfully, They're seeing fire on the desert sands out there because they want to help. They want to help with a marketing campaign and a TV or radio interview. They're all very similar. And you could get their $200 membership or their $500 membership
Yeah.
and all that kind of stuff. And I did one of them. I did one of them. And the quality of the interview, I did well, but the rest of them did terrible. The quality of the interview was awful. So now I've demanded that they do sound editing on it because it's just terrible. Well, I took the $200 lowest membership, and I guess I sure got what I deserve. So I get those
Oh.
every day, a different one, a new one. They
Yeah.
some of them want to know. They want to just talk to me about how do I think about things and tell us, how you wrote your book and things like that. All toward the hook. All toward the hook.
Yes. And then they say, well, if you want to continue and you want an interview on BBC Four, that's what I got recently, was the BBC wants to interview me. You have to pay to register to be part of BBC Four, to be listed so them to consider to pick you up as an interview. I'm like, oh my gosh, like they manipulate you left and right, and it's horrible,
Well, what Juliana says is we what we didn't do enough of. So we're writing a prequel right now. Matter of fact, the manuscript is drafted. It's been beta read once, and I'm sending it out again. And the thing that she wants is let's try to go directly to publishers and get them. So the prequel is kind of be like Desiree's growing up years, all the way to where she sets off on the adventure that begins with Fire on the Desert Sands. So it's from the day she's born up until then. So it's kind of like a coming of
Right.
age. It's like a novella. And she's saying, let's try to see whether we could get a publisher to publish it. Because if they agree to publish it and it's not a vanity press, let's say it's a press where they will publish it and you don't have to pay them anything, then you have struck gold. Because they're going to put some effort, maybe not as much as if they thought it was going to be like a giant bestseller, but they're going to put some effort into the marketing and the advertising of it,
Yeah,
and
because
you've
they want to
struck
make
gold.
money.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah. So if you could get a publisher to take your book, if you could get them to accept your book, and I don't know. I've always been so afraid. I mean, I've tried doing it and gotten rejections. Fire in a Desert Sand got rejected by Harlequin Press twice, and then we revamped that book completely, and then I was too scared to go back to them, so then we went to the self-publishing mode. But so that is the way to strike gold, to get a publisher to take your book. And Lord knows there's enough advice and counsel and how to
Yeah.
classes. You could take lots of classes on how to get somebody to accept your book and how to pursue the publisher and keep track of your efforts and your
There's
work and
no
all that stuff.
guarantees. There's no
No,
guarantees.
and
So
I'm
then you're
figuring,
spending money on all these classes that might come up to nothing.
yeah.
So you're in the same boat, whether it's people trying to manipulate you to tell we would love your book and whatever. There's always a, like you said, there's always a hook. Somewhere, and I think we just need to be diligent and support each other and share what's legit and what's not. And if you do decide to go the traditional route, it's going to take time and significant amount of effort, and there's still no guarantee. So
Yeah.
whichever way you go with your prequel, it'll be the right way, it'll show itself to
We
you.
have another question from
All
Cheryl.
right, one
Hey,
more question, then we
Cheryl.
have to wrap up. Hi, Cheryl.
I'll be real quick. Congratulations, and don't be scared. If you're scared, come on. I'll be your rooting. I'll be your cheerleader, and then we got to cheerlead each other because I need it too. Your prequel, put it up for pre-order. You can pre have it up for pre-order, and then you can market the heck out of it.
So
Oh,
that's my
okay.
suggestion
All
because
right.
it's what I'm learning I'm going to do next. So thank you. That's it.
Thanks,
I'll share.
Cheryl.
Great
Thank you.
idea.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So Anthony, tell us how we can get your book.
Okay, Amazon.com, Kindle, a lot of the smaller resellers that the Dvorkins put it on, and also Barnes and Nobles. They're mostly through their websites. And right now it is also available on Bookshare for people who want to read the book as an adapted book, and it's in the queue for Bard. It'd probably be several months before they get to it. So all of the main resellers of books out there, and a lot of them will have this book.
Thank you. Anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
Yeah, I want to thank you, and I want to thank Behind Our Eyes and our entire family for being so supportive and giving me this opportunity to do what I love doing, which is talking. And Juliana and I really appreciate you helping us to launch our book. We really love this.
Oh, well, thank you for coming and thank you everybody for coming on the call and thank you, Linda, for helping out and I look forward to your next book and you will get this up on the website as soon as possible so you're able to share the recording with everybody.
Thank you. Appreciate
All
it.
right. Have a good
So,
night. Take care, everybody.
well,
Yes.
hold on. I'm supposed to do my spiel
Oh, right,
about
Lisa. I'm sorry.
that's okay. So I'm just here as the president of Behind Our Eyes to talk about all the programs we have. When you join Behind Our Eyes, you will be welcomed by the one pilot in our pilots, team, and they will tell you about everything that you need to know, and you can ask them questions and help you. We have a main email list, excuse me, where you can post your writings and we'll get comments, if you want them, about your writing. We have genre lists, which we feature a different genre every month. Right now we're doing poetry because it's poetry month. We have a marketing list. We have several critique groups. We have our Sunday night programs twice a month. Actually, we're going to have them three times a month this month, but normally we have them twice a month, where sometimes we have a speaker, sometimes we have critiques, and sometimes we have like workshops. We have Friday write-ins where you can come and sort of say what you're going to write and then come back and tell us whether you've succeeded in writing it or not. We have once a month submission parties, which you do the same thing. You say what you're going to submit, go submit it, and come back and tell everyone. We have a writer's exchange classes where people, sorry, I don't know what's going on with my voice, but where you can get a free class by one of the members of BOE. And we've had several classes so far. And if you ever want to teach a class, please get in touch with Brad. We have three anthologies, and a fourth one being worked on right now. Of course, we have our magazine twice a year, Magnets and Ladders. And we have once a month readers workshops where you can just come and read your work and in a very peaceful environment, and people are very kind about what you read. And then of course we have our book launch committee and our Zoom committee. We have a web liaison. Marilyn is our and Jay work on the web a lot. And we have Marilyn's also the chair of the nominating committee. And I think I
got everything. So thank you, Tony, and Juliana for coming tonight. And I congratulate you on your book. It sounds very exciting. And we'll look forward to reading your prequel.
Thank
So
you. Good
now we can say good night.
night.
Good night.
Bye.